Paul Andrews with the Business Bunker.
Welcome back to the Business Bunker Show on KentBusinessRadio.co.uk and ChannelRadio.co.uk on this Tuesday, the 29th of March. You're with me, Paul Andrews, and the marvellous, the newly christened Marvellous Martin.
I'm going to have to get my head shaved now.
Yeah, you are, aren't you? And fight Sugar Ray Leonard. So, Martin, Marvellous Martin, let's do an email.
Right, okay. So, Kent Invicta Chamber always put on some fantastic networking events. Not least, Muesli Mafia Networking. The next events are 14th of April, Royal Tunbridge Wells, 11th of May, the Warren Bromley, and 26th of May, back in Maidstone at the Great Danes. That's normally the one I go to, which is fantastic. They've also got some afternoon tea on Wednesday, the 8th of June, at Brands Hatch. So lots of Muesli Mafia events taking place. I guess the best place to look at all of those is on the Kent Invicta Chamber website.
Absolutely. We've had a tweet from Kent Tweet Ups, and they say their next tweet up is this Thursday, the 31st, at Linley's. That will be in Roper Road, Canterbury, won't it?
Yep.
That's Roper Road, Canterbury, in Linley's. Is Dennis, head of beds, still working there?
I don't know Dennis personally.
Do you not know Dennis? Dennis was head of beds at Linley's some time ago. I just wondered if he was still there. If he is, hello Dennis. Anyway, let's tweet up at Linley's. And it's on Thursday the 31st, 10 a.m. I guess. And you can find out about that and all the other Kent tweet ups by going to their website, which is kentbusinesstweetup.co.uk.
ABC Networks are also running an event, networking event, their normal bi-weekly breakfast at in Ashford, at the Blacksmith's Arms on Thursday morning from 7 till 9. That's one that David and I frequent quite often.
Is it?
We went there for lunch as well last week, so we need to take out shares in the Blacksmith's Arms. But that's Thursday, 7 till 9, ABC Networks.
Fantastic.
Great meeting.
Cool. We've had a tweet from Caroline and Liz. The Organic Sisters, I said Organic Sisters, they're Riverford_Kent, and they say, Vanilla Web, Martin, and everyone else, hello, we're delivering fresh fruit and veg and pantry across Kent. So do check out Liz and Caroline, Riverford_Kent. They have the Kent franchise for Riverford Organic Food.
Can they get here in the next hour and deliver a cake for Dave so we can all have a piece?
Can we have organic cake? It'll have to be a carrot cake, won't it? Cool. Good. Do you know what? I think it's about time we brought some decorum, some common sense, and some business acumen to this show. So it's an absolute pleasure to welcome, for the first time, onto the Business Bunker show, Mr. Stephen Askew. Stephen, welcome to the Business Bunker.
And thank you very much. I'm not sure I'm going to bring decorum, but let's have some fun.
Yeah. First time for everything, bit of decorum. Stephen is a partner in Haynes Watts Chartered Accountants. He's also the representative for the Federation of Small Business East Kent Region. And we're going to be talking about exit strategies and things like that in a moment. But if you wouldn't mind, Stephen, I'd just like a bit of background to you, what you do, how you do it, and who Haynes Watts are.
Right, how did I get here?
Yeah.
That's my father's fault. He felt laying drains was a bit of a waste for a grammar school education. So at the age of 18, I joined an accountancy practice, an international practice in London, and qualified as a chartered accountant. Knowing that London wasn't where I wanted to be, we looked for opportunities outside, and along came a retiring accountant on the Kent coast, and at the age of 29, I took over the firm.
Wow.
And ran it for 30 years until it was time to look to the future. Hmm. Like most professions, life's getting more complex. Our clients' needs are getting more complex.
Oh, without doubt.
And I looked for a larger umbrella to work with, and accountancy is one of those things that if you put yourself on the market, you're going to have lots of suitors, and I did. Mm. But why Haynes Watts? I liked Haynes Watts' culture. Mm. I liked the client service side of it. I liked the fact in Kent we were allowed to dictate our own pricing structures and the way we deal with our clients. We weren't being dictated to by a head office about how we did those important things about looking after clients, and yet nationally, 66 offices, 70 million turnover. I've got every specialist at the end of a phone than I could ever want.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. It's one of the things I do like about it, is you've got the best of both worlds here.
Absolutely.
And this is really clever. You've got all the structure that goes behind it of a large firm, but you've got none of the drawbacks of large firms, which are they normally ignore their customers. Because each branch, for want of a better word, of Haynes Watts is like a small standalone accountancy on its own, but backed by all of this stuff behind it. And that's one of the lovely things that I like about that organisation.
And more clients, especially in Kent, are dealing internationally.
Yep.
And we have an international network. If you want to know what the tax laws are in a small province in northern China, within a few hours I can let you know.
Right.
And that's a great advantage, especially for somebody who's looking maybe not to learn new skills now at the stage I am. I'm leaving that to the youngsters.
Richard Marshall, the tax guy in Maidstone, probably knows that off the top of his head anyway, doesn't he?
Yeah. He knows an awful lot.
Yeah, it's Zaipong District taxes. I mean, he's bound to know that without even blinking. So that's cool. And so I know we're going to go on and talk about something else, but it's interesting because you, to some extent, have actually been through a similar type of process to that which we're going to talk about, which is, one, acquiring a firm, and then, two, kind of divesting a firm.
Absolutely. I've been at both ends, and, yeah, and we're very much in the structure of succession and looking at the partner's own exit strategies over the next few years. It's not going to happen over the next 1 or 2 years, but we're already planning for what would be happening in 5 to 10 years' time.
And this is the crucial thing, is it not, when you're thinking about businesses and that kind of thing, that there's a plan in place, or a general direction of travel at the very least. You've got to know what you're trying to do.
Oh, absolutely. You've got to have a good reason why. And you've got to know where you're going. Mm. And you do have to think about it a long way. Yeah. But planning is the big word. You know, I don't do much compliance work. If you want me to do a set of accounts, please don't ask me. I've got some great people that do that for me. If you want me to do a tax return, don't ask me. I've got great people that do that for me. If you want me to help a business develop or an exit strategy, then you'll end up talking to me. And we're always talking about planning, but never more is succession dependent on a strong business plan. It is the foundation for long-term succession or exit strategy.
Absolutely. It's interesting, isn't it? I work at the other end of the market as an angel investor, primarily with startup businesses. But I have exactly the same problem there, because when I come along and start talking to people about taking an equity investment in their business, my first question is, what's your exit strategy? And they always look at me astounded and they go, exit? We haven't even started the business yet. And I go, but you want me to invest. There's got to be a reason that I'm investing, and that reason is to make some money. And one of the only ways I'm going to do that is if we exit the business and sell it to someone. Otherwise, I'm not going to get my money back. So, and I would say probably 90% of people are shocked by the fact that before they've started a business, they need an exit plan.
Absolutely. Mm. In fact, most people that start businesses have always got it in mind that they will sell it one day, unless they're going to build it to pass it on to members of the family. But that in itself is a form of sale.
I was going to say, but that's still an exit plan, isn't it?
It absolutely is.
You don't have to sell the business. You can pass it on in another way. But it's still an exit for you.
Yeah, and if it's not family, we see a lot of management buyouts.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
And it's still a succession. It's still an exit strategy. It still has to be planned for over many years.
Absolutely. So I want to kind of explore this, if I may, a little bit in terms of when faced with a business, presumably a reasonably successful business. Otherwise, some businesses have to exit and sell for other kinds of reasons, they're going down the pan. So let's leave that aside for 1 minute. We might come back to that in a moment. But a reasonably successful business, someone thinking about retirement or exiting a business because now's the time to do it, or soon will be. What's the kind of starting point with something like that? I'm keen to hear two things, really, here. how most people go about it, i.e. so the reality, what normally happens when someone walks into your office and goes, hello, Stephen, I'm thinking of selling, or what do I do? Not even thinking of selling, what do I do? So I want to hear the reality of that. And then I want to explore what we should be doing, if you see what I mean.
Yeah, it's because every case is different.
Yeah.
And when people come and see me, probably the first hour, 2 hours, is just me listening and asking the odd question. Mm. Just to see what people's culture is and what they want out of it. Mm. One of the first things I may have to do is give realistic expectations. People are looking at high values for businesses, but not all businesses attract high values. So we have to look very professionally at what we can reasonably expect to achieve from the sale of a business. The other thing is letting go. Mm. And most business owners, especially those that were the original startup, have real problems letting go. Mm. And you can't sell yourself. You have to sell a business. Mm. And sadly, an awful lot of people come to us and they think they've got a business, but they don't. What they'll actually do is working for themselves.
Yeah.
And that you can't really sell unless you're going to go and work for somebody for a while.
Yeah.
But to have a true business, it must be able to carry on without you.
Absolutely.
Now, that may not be today, but you may have 3 or 4 or 5 years to engineer that business so it will work without you. You've got to become dispensable. And so when we're looking and talking to especially new clients or people that we don't act as accountants for but come and see me with this very specialized advice, is where are they in that process? Where do they see themselves? Are they the one person around which the business runs? Or are they sitting to the side and supporting the business and encouraging other people to do that work?
Yep.
And you have to look at who you've got in the business, who else is in the business, and who could continue that, and whether the relationships in the business are transferable.
Absolutely. I want to come back to something you said right up front about people's expectations of sales, because I personally came across this some time ago, and it was actually very sad, really, and disappointing for them. I was approached 18 months, 2 years ago by a reasonably successful small business that wanted an exit sale. The people that owned it were looking to retire. They were well past retirement age already. And they had a reasonably successful little business. And they came to me and said, would you like to buy it? And I had a look at the business and I thought, actually, that's not a bad little business. And I said, yeah. And I'd kind of be looking at this kind of price. And they fell about laughing and they went, you're joking. We want, you know, millions. It wasn't actually millions, but do you know what I mean? They wanted an order of magnitude far and above what I offered them. And I said, in all honesty, I have to tell you, your business is not worth that. You know, and this is where I want to ask you some questions here, Stephen. Really horrible questions that I know you can't answer because there is no answer. But back at that time, we were looking at service business sales on a multiple of 6x earnings, roughly.
Yeah.
So I just use that as a rule of thumb. You know, what's their revenues? 6x that's what I'll offer you. And they went, you're joking, da, 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 da. So I pulled out of the deal. It wasn't. I happened to find out that they actually sold the business eventually about 2 months ago for a quarter of what I offered them initially, because they got so desperate they just took an offer eventually. And that's sad, because they'd taken their eye off the ball as well, and they were so determined to retire, they weren't building a business or developing it, so it was running downhill. So that's a bit of a long-winded way of asking you these days, looking at service businesses, you know, what's the starting point? If you're trying to value, if you're trying to get some kind of idea of what your business might be worth, where do you start?
With the buyer.
Yeah. Yeah.
In truth, you know, and forgive me for, you know, reciting something that I do say. It sounds probably accountancy, but the value of a business is the net present value of the future cash flows the buyer will receive from that business. Mm. So the value of a business is got more about the future than the past. Now I know a lot of people will value businesses based on the last 3 years accounts and average earnings and all these EBITDAs, which people throw around, and all this jargon. Mm. But actually, it's about what's going to happen in the future. Mm-hmm. So we have to look forward. Yes, the past is an indicator of the future. But just the fact it will be changing hands will change the future. And that's why the value of a business can vary totally by who's buying it. Mm. Because if the firm that are buying it, the business that's buying it, is going to get great savings because they're in the same industry, they're going to be closing down units, they're going to be restructuring.
Or taking out competition, in fact.
Or taking out competition. But that business can generate a lot more cash by buying the business for sale mm. than somebody coming in from the outside and saying, I fancy doing that, I think I'll buy that business. Mm. So quite often, the best buyers you can get are your competitors.
Yeah, trade sale. Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely, yeah. Because they will be prepared to pay more because they will generate more cash, especially in the first, say, 3 years.
And as you identified, there's more value to them in the business from other points of view other than just the cash flow and revenues, turnovers and profit.
Yeah, I've got a valuation going on at the moment, and it's been an incredibly profitable business over the last 5 years. Mm. But they've just lost 70% of their customer base.
Wow.
So the future...
That was unfortunate.
That was very unfortunate. It's
probably down the back of the sofa if they look down there.
You know, so actually, what's that business worth? I would say the business is worth what it's got in the bank.
Right, okay.
Because there's not enough ongoing orders to generate a profit other than that will cover the owner's salaries. Right. And that's the other thing that a lot of people don't take into consideration, especially with us accountants doing our tax planning and extracting profits by anything other than a salary. People forget to adjust the profits for the real cost of running a business. Mm. And so sometimes, you know, people look at their profits and say, oh, we want five times that. Yeah, but that's actually not the right profit figure that we have to start with.
Sure, yeah. I mean, a lot of this... It depends on the balance sheet, and there's all kinds of things that you're looking at. With a privately owned business, there's all kinds of things that, you know, can be added back in, taken out, taken into account. You know, if the owner of the business has been buying themselves a new Ferrari every year and stuff like that on the company, you can see that in the books and go, well, hold on a minute, we might not do that. One of the things that I'm also interested in, because when I talk to people about such things, they don't always understand this, especially with a service business, is an earn-out.
Yeah.
Maybe you could touch on that, Stephen.
Well, these are becoming far more popular now.
Yeah.
For many reasons. Yes, we can go to the banks and the difficulty in raising finance in certain areas, and some changes in tax laws which have stopped us using company assets to secure loans. So a lot of people want to sell their businesses, people want to buy those businesses, but they don't have the money. Mm. And so what they do is come to an agreement that they will pay the value of the business over 5 years, maybe even as long as 10 years, but normally it's 3 to 5 years.
Yep.
And then the new owners can finance the purchase of the business from the profits of that business. Mm. Of course, we do have problems sometimes because the profits don't always cover the repayments, and the new owners aren't always realistic about what they can personally take out of the business and what they have to leave in the business for the previous owner. Mm. There are lots of protections that we put in for the sellers, making sure that if the money does dry up, that they can take action, that they can look at even, in fact, I've got one case where they've sold the same company 3 times on an earn-out because each earn-out failed, so they took the business back,
right.
And now it's been broken down and there's been an asset sale.
Right, okay.
So before you go into an earn-out, you have to be very confident, plus you have to protect yourself.
Absolutely. Cool. And just for completeness, how does that compare to a management buyout?
Most management buyouts are earnouts.
Yeah.
Most management buyouts we see are earnouts. It is very rare that we see that the managers in a business, people that have been employed all their lives, unless they've come into an inheritance or they want to refinance their house, that they'll have anywhere near the sum that they need to buy out. So normally, most of the acquisition is an earn-out.
Okay, cool. Martin's going to dive in there.
Yeah, I just wanted to touch on something you said earlier, Paul, about, you know, that one of the first questions you ask of someone that wants to sell their business, you know, what's your exit strategy, you know, if they want you to invest in a business. And for me, it's so fundamental to think about how you're going to balance what you want to achieve in business with what you want to achieve in your personal life.
Yep.
Because ultimately, if you own a business, the two are totally 100% interlinked.
Absolutely.
And the whole reason you own a business is because ultimately you want to have more control over your ability to ultimately create a life that you want outside of that business.
Absolutely.
So to not have an exit strategy in place on day one means you haven't really thought about what you want your life to look like in the next 5 or 10 years' time. So for me, the two are intrinsically linked on that
Absolutely.
Level.
Absolutely. And funnily enough, it's actually broader than that as well. As those of us that are getting on in years suddenly start to realise when we have a substantial business, there are all kinds of other impacts as well. You know, there's inheritance. If you suddenly get hit by the proverbial bus, there's a whole heap of issues here. If a spouse or children inherit your business, are they capable of running it? Do they want to run it? What's the impact on the staff and management? You know, so you get loads of things now where people starting to look at, well, hold on a minute. This business could go kaput if we lost the major shareholder through illness or accident. You know, what would happen? So there's some protections you can put in place for that. But that's another thing to be considered is that, you know, even if you're not selling the business on the open market, you might exit by passing on to another generation. And so there's so many things to look at.
And I've got a lot of sad stories, which I won't go through today, of exactly that happening. Mm. But you touched on something there, which I was going to come to. We think about business owners and we think about businesses and we think about the customers and the supply chain. Mm. But in terms of succession, what you really have to think about more than anything else are the team.
Yeah.
The people you employ. Mm-hmm. Not only do you have to have the right people in place, you have to have the right level of team engagement. You have to have them engaged in the business. Mm. Because the biggest barrier, one of the biggest barriers to selling a business is the business owner that hasn't engaged its team, who hasn't trained a team to be able to run that business. Mm. As I said earlier, you have to be separate. You have to be able to stand away and let the business run without you, especially towards the end of the plan. Mm. So it is actually about investing in your team to give them, because there sometimes are skill gaps we have to fill. We have to identify them. We have to say, do we need to bring somebody in? Can we train somebody to do that? Mm. And we have to allow them to do it, because one of the biggest difficulties that business owners have is delegation.
Oh, absolutely.
And if you don't delegate, you won't empower people, you won't train people, there will be no one to do your job. So if you suddenly, you know, one of the vast skiing trips you do or whatever, you break a leg, you're in hospital, you're not there, have you got a team that can manage your business when you're not there? Mm. And if you're going to sell, that's where you start. You start with a team. In fact, it's a rule across almost any business facet. Hmm. Look at the team.
Absolutely.
Look at the team.
And I want to wrap up with another horrible question, because I like doing this to you, Stephen.
That's okay.
As a rule of thumb, and I know it's going to be a rule of thumb, how far out do you think is appropriate to start thinking about? I mean, you should think about it all the time, but if you want to be serious about exiting your business, What's a good period of time to be planning this?
I normally say 5 years.
Right.
And although I've said that it's about future cash flows, it's not about always about the past accounts, we're quite often negotiating with other parties that are totally reliant on the past accounts, and they don't necessarily understand what's the rest of us do. So when you're grooming a business for sale, we're not buying any new Ferraris. Mm. So we're not having to suffer that amortization.
Yeah.
So we're grooming the business to look as it would do with a new owner.
Yeah.
Without those things going on in that a lot of companies do. So you may wish not to invest so heavily.
Right.
Which seems counterintuitive.
but if you invest heavily, then there's a lot more in terms of depreciation, so it's hitting the profit. But it's also increasing the value of the business, making it more difficult to find a buyer.
Right.
We also have to look at things like properties.
Yep.
Should the property be in the company that's for sale, or should it be taken out?
Right.
Generally, we'll probably take it out, but it depends on the property and the type of business it is. The one thing that I've learned over 40-odd years is there are no rules.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Every, you know, and an old friend of mine used to say that a prescription without diagnosis is malpractice. So every case has to be different. We have to ask the right questions. And if I think I do anything, it's ask the right questions.
Cool.
And the answers quite often just fall out of the answers that are there.
Right.
So, yeah.
Good stuff. Stephen, thank you so much for that. A really fascinating look at exit strategies and really useful and important information.
It's been a great pleasure.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for coming in. Stephen Watts, partner at Haynes Watts. Thank you so much for joining us on the Business Bunker.
Thank you.
We've had a tweet as well from Sally Gridley. And Sally says, hi, Vanilla Web. Can you say hi to Stephen? She said, I worked with him a few years ago when he was chair of the Canterbury Early Years Project. Horrible bloke. Oh, no, she's a lovely guy.
and I still am involved. I helped set up the Canterbury Early Years Project.
Right.
We ran children's centres before the government invested them.
Right.
They're still involved. It still does fantastic work. And if anybody from KCC is listening, can we please have some additional funding this year to continue the excellent work that we've done for the last 20 years?
Brilliant. Good stuff. Good luck with the funding. But cool. So thank you for that, Sally. And thank you, Stephen. I think we're going to do a couple more emails, please, Martin.
Okay. Kent and Victor Chamber are running a multitude of after-hours networking events starting today at the Mercure in Maidstone from 6 to 7.30pm. Next Tuesday at the Nucleus Centre in Dartford, also the Conningbrook Ashford. The week after that, the Farmhouse in Westmorling. So these are weekly after-hours networking events. Please have a look at the Kent Invicta Chamber website for more information on those.
Fantastic, thank you. We've still got tweets coming in. We've had a tweet from Evolve Excel. Evolve Excel on Twitter, loving the show. We're a tech startup in Maidstone, and we're transforming your Excel spreadsheets online. They have given me a shortened link to their website, which I can't read, obviously. So the easiest thing to do is to follow them on the Twitter at Evolve Excel. Do take a look at that.
Going to bring it down to a slightly more local level here now, Paul. A new concert venue is being launched at the Tin Tabernacle in Hythe. Do you know that, Paul? It's a lovely old church, apparently.
Yes, yeah, I do know of it, yeah.
Providing a wonderfully intimate atmosphere and acoustics in which to enjoy music. So that sounds like you can lose yourself at the first concert, which will be held on the 12th of May with singer-songwriter Rab Noakes headlining. How do you book on? Tickets are limited, can be purchased from Art Right in Hythe High Street and also Shane Record Art Studio, the old High Street in Folkestone.
Fantastic, thank you. Sally's gone, great to hear, Stephen, that you're still doing good things. So, cool. And we've also had a tweet from the lovely folks at Venom Tech over there at Discovery Park who say, hope you all had a great Easter, loving the show, some great tunage. Of course, it's Cheese Central here, don't you worry. Sevenoaks, Friday the 22nd of April, 10 a.m. to 2 p.m. is the Sevenoaks Business Show, and it will be opened by the Right Honourable Michael Fallon MP, Secretary of State for Defence. It's business networking, presentations and exhibits, and there are 100 goodie bags up for grabs. It's at the Stag Theatre, Plaza Suite, London Road, Sevenoaks, TN13 1ZZ. And that's, as I say, on Friday the 22nd of April. Do get along to that. It's a lovely little show. I went to it last year. It was a real cracker.
I'm all out of events, Paul, but I just I'm really, really just thinking about what Stephen was saying and, you know, the kind of the harsh realities in many ways of what it means to be in business and ultimately be a success in business. And it's quite humbling, isn't it, to listen to some of that in terms of, you know, the things, the questions that you've got to ask yourself And these are difficult questions as well. You know,
absolutely.
How do you manage your business? How do you manage the staff in your business? All these kinds of key areas that are going to be vital if ultimately you want to make a success at exiting your business at some point. So some real food for thought there, and I'm going to go back and download that and listen again, I think.
Absolutely. And Stephen just wanted to make a point.
The one point I forgot is it a business is much easier to sell if everyone has fun in it.
Oh, absolutely.
And then people take themselves too seriously. Mm. A great mentor of mine, a man called Peter Thompson, once said that business is fun with a serious intent.
Right.
And I think that's a great mantra. I'd just quickly like to thank you for... I've never done this before. You probably can tell that, but I've really enjoyed it. But you've given me permission to plug a couple of events.
Yeah.
With my FSB representative hat on, I'd like to. I also, like Paul, am chairing an EU referendum debate. This one is much more local. It's in Folkestone on the 14th of April, 9 o'clock at the Lees Hall.
So I'm going to come to yours. I'm going to come to yours and get some tips because mine's not till after yours.
Yeah, that's good. Well, good luck with getting the tips. But it will be as Paul and I, we will be neutral on the day. Mm. And the other thing he's allowed me to plug, as one of my other hats, is president of the Rotary Club of Margate. We're having a quiz on the 15th at the Northumberland Golf Club. If you like quizzes, it will be an excellent one. We've got an ex-local headmaster asking the questions.
Uh-oh.
And it's okay, he's not over bright, so there's some quite easy ones. But he's a lovely, lovely man. He's very good at it. So my email address is saskew@hwca.com. That's saskew@hwca.com. If you like quizzes, come and see me.
Fantastic, thank you.
And we've got a wonderful little par 3 18-hole course there. So you could get there early, not overly exert yourself. But
knock a few balls in.
Play a few holes and then go along to Stephen's event after that.
And why not? What better could you ask for? We've had a tweet from the gorgeously lovely Natalie Benaig, who says, Vanilla Web, please could you mention that it's the last 2 days to become a category sponsor at the Kent Creative Awards, promotion and networking with the Kent Creative Sector. If you'd like to find out more about that, then give Natalie a follow. Kent Creative Art is her Twitter handle, or you can listen to her at 4 o'clock this afternoon on the Kent Creative Show here on Channel Radio. But you know what? It's that time in the show again when...
Channel Radio News Update.
It's that time when we bring you the news update from the Federation of Small Business. And the FSB are creating high-quality jobs. Small and micro businesses have created the highest number of jobs since the recession. A study by the IPPR from April 2014 shows that 84% of new jobs created in the private sector between 2010 and 2013 were in SMEs. Small firms are more likely to play a social as well as an economic role compared to large companies. The FSB has taken action to call on policymakers to recognise the critical role that SMEs play in creating high-quality jobs in local communities, and they've been lobbying the Treasury for the employment allowance to be increased to help businesses take on staff to increase training and pay. And they're promoting the benefits of flexible working for productivity, performance and recruitment among small employers. The goal of the FSB in this is they want policymakers to help build an environment that actually encourages job creation yet provides practical support for small firms. Mm. Cool.
I've got a really interesting one here. I'm not sure if you read this out last week, but companies required to make available on the public register a list of all people with significant control over the business. So I assume we're talking about individuals that have some kind of shareholding in a business.
25% and above.
Okay. And the companies will ultimately be responsible for disclosing that information to Companies House via the PSC register. So I would imagine that will hit an awful lot of businesses, and it's just another requirement.
Another piece of pointless red tape, just so the government can interfere in everything. Yeah.
And frankly, I don't know why, because we all have to complete something called an annual return, don't we, for our businesses if we have a limited company. Why do we need this additional burden?
One of the rationales behind this is that a lot of companies you know, with company returns, you put in company directors and company's house and stuff like that, you put in the officers, but you don't always see who has a controlling interest in the company. And that controlling interest can also be hidden. So you can hide it in other vehicles.
Right.
So one of the reasons they've put this register in place is they want to know the name of the person with the ultimate controlling interest.
You're right. So for example, if you have an investment vehicle that has invested in your business through an enterprise investment scheme, it may not that interest may not be held in that individual's name. It might be held in their investment vehicle name.
And they want to know who that individual is and what role they have in having a controlling interest in the company, which is why it only pertains to people that own 25% or more of a company. There's a new national insurance guide that's been published. Whoopee-doo. HMRC has published a new guide for employers to assist with the new national insurance contributions relief for apprentices who are under the age of 25. The changes, which come into force on the 6th of April 2016, will result in employers not having to pay Class 1 national insurance contributions on earnings of apprentices below £827 per week. This is provided that the apprentice is under 25 and is following an approved apprenticeship program. In order to apply for the national insurance relief, employers need to provide evidence to HMRC, which is a written agreement between the employer, the apprentice, and the accredited training provider. And it also has to state the end date of the apprenticeship.
Something that Stephen was touching on earlier when he was talking about small businesses and exit strategies. Leadership skills shortfall, holding back UK economy, says the FSB. So what we're talking about here is a lack of leadership and management training in particular, holding back small businesses and their development ultimately. And this is something that we touched on the other week, wasn't it, Paul, with East Kent College and their professional development programme.
Absolutely, yep.
And the fact that, you know, there's an awful lot of specialist skills training available to small business owners and management in small businesses, but very little of it ultimately is being taken up.
Absolutely.
But if businesses are going to be successful, ultimately, they've got to invest in themselves. Dave. Yeah.
David.
Yeah, sorry, I wanted to come in here because one of the reasons for this is because the business owners themselves just do not recognise the fact that they need these leadership skills. Yeah. So it's not just a case of this, they're looking at what they're doing and what they've got and saying, no, I'm okay. It's the fact they're just not equipped to think properly about the future, what's going to be needed, and to take an objective look at the skill set they've got.
Absolutely. I can't emphasise that enough. I totally agree with David. Many, many years ago, I used to do customer service training, and I was engaged by an incredibly well-known and very wealthy investment bank, a really big one, and they said to me, we need our staff trained on customer service because they're appalling. So of course I set off to do this, and nobody wanted to come. Everyone went, customer service, we know how to do that. I'm going, well, why do you think they're paying me loads and loads of money to come in here if you all know how to do it? And they went, oh, I don't know, they're stupid. You're absolutely right, David. So many people don't recognize what they lack because they don't know they lack it.
Because we're not classically trained business people.
Exactly.
You know, we're very good at what we do, but we haven't necessarily had a traditional business education in that respect.
Yeah.
You're hitting here on a passion of mine, you know, Paul, because you're talking about customer service. So I wonder how many people think in terms of customer care as well. Mm. Customer care, of course, being the answer to that question, do I actually give a damn
terms
of the way I do my customer service?
Oh, you've spoken to BT, have you?
I mean, what's really interesting here is, you know, clearly there is a recognised skill shortage here in small businesses, and yet you've got the Department for Business Innovation and Skills having just cut a fantastic vehicle for allowing small businesses to access exactly that kind of training through the Growth Accelerator programme, for example.
Joined up or something, is it?
Yeah, exactly. So if you've got a powerful organisation like the FSB doing research and telling government ultimately what needs to be done at a small business level, how on earth are the government ultimately, you know, able to turn a blind eye to that and ignore that ignore that research?
I mean, and that is one of the great benefits of the FSB. They are a lobbying organisation. They do take to government the issues that their members, over 200,000 of them raised with it. They can't make the government do it, obviously, and the government come out with all kinds of excuses why they can't do things, but, you know, they at least try. Mm. Landlords of residential premises, red tape warning. Landlords of residential premises are now required to check the immigration status of prospective tenants and other occupiers to ascertain the individual's right to rent in the UK. Oh, blimey. In January 2016, the government passed the Immigration Act 2014, Commencement Order Number 6, which introduces a requirement on private landlords to make right to rent checks of prospective tenants aged 18 and over before the start of a new tenancy entered into on or after the 1st of February 2016. The requirement applies to all tenants, whether or not they are named on the tenancy, even if there's no written tenancy or tenancy agreement. You could fall about laughing with this, couldn't you? If landlords fail to comply, they may be fined up to £3,000. Landlords must carry out the checks in a non-discriminatory manner and need to avoid contravening the Equality Act 2010. Okay.
This is where landlords are going to have a lot of fun over the next few years. Mm. This government doesn't appear to like private residential landlords at the moment.
No.
The budget was very much against them over the last year, and this recent budget, although a lot of the moves against earning money from property is to try and drive people back to invest in equities, and a couple of the tax changes are really pushing incentives to go back in stocks and shares rather than deposit accounts or property. But looking at East Kent, I'm really concerned what happens if we don't have enough private landlords at the moment.
I was just going to say, it's laudable to want people to invest in technology, stock shares, equities, whatever, bonds, and all the rest of it. But how about places to live? You know, they are somewhat important. And because we don't have a mortgage market anymore, because you can't borrow any money from anybody, and the price of houses continues its inexorable rise, especially here in the southeast, a thriving rental market is the only option, isn't it? And if you stop people being private landlords, where is anyone going to live? Mm. But there you go.
I've got a really interesting one here for you, Paul. I know you're going to have a view on this. Councils will gain control over Sunday trading. So the idea here is that local authorities in England and Wales will have more power to decide ultimately what their Sunday, what the Sunday opening hours of their local businesses are going to be. But the justification for this, the devolution of Sunday trading rules is expected to give a boost to local high street traders competing with online retailers. Why draw a direct comparison there with an online retailer and a high street shop? I don't understand that, Paul. What's your view?
You don't have to worry about it, Martin. And I'll tell you why you don't have to worry about it. It's one of George's U-turns. He's just abandoned that plan.
Has he?
Yeah.
Okay, that's out of date before it was even written.
No, that only came in a few days ago, but George did a U-turn on that when somebody shouted at him. So that's gone.
Great.
For the moment. They will try and reintroduce it, I'm sure, but at the moment it's been stopped. Financial penalties coming to force from April 2016 for employers who fail to pay tribunal awards. The government has confirmed that it expects Section 150 of the Small Business Enterprise and Employment Act 2015 to come into force from April 2016. Section 150 amends the Employment Tribunals Act 1996 to enable financial penalties to be imposed on employers who fail to pay either an Employment Tribunal financial reward or an ACAS conciliated settlement sum. So if you get fined, pay the fine, basically. And if you don't, you get another fine.
I've got another really interesting one here about the audit threshold being increased to £10 million plus.
Yep.
So £10 million plus turnover and a balance sheet of over £5 million. So, you know, clearly, in theory, that reduces the burden on small businesses, but does it? Because ultimately, financial reporting is there for a reason. It's to help the business owner run a better business primarily.
Absolutely. I'm sure Stephen's going to have something to say about this. They have started to move some of the regulations, and Steve will know this better than I do, on, and it's now becoming a much harder thing to determine whether you have a limited company or you operate as a sole trader, and especially as they push some of the numbers out as well.
Well, it's getting very complex, and we're certainly reviewing a lot of our limited companies with a view to maybe taking them back to limited liability partnerships. And a lot of the anti-avoidance on profit extraction rules that came out in this budget may change us. The audits are really interesting. Within Haynes Watts, nationally, we do a significant number of audits, the majority of which are not statutory audits. They're below the current thresholds, but for lots of reasons. You know, I still conduct audits for the branches and subsidiaries of overseas companies, where the overseas companies want that confidence that the accounts are representing a true and fair view, which is what the law says. So a lot of companies do have audits, and they will continue. If you've got a company turning over 8 million, they're still going to need an audit, because they're going to hope within the next year or so they're going to be turning over 10 million.
Yeah.
And the fact, if you haven't had an audit 1 year, it creates confusion. You end up 2 years. So there's lots of reasons companies will, but for a reason.
And I also presume, and you'll put me straight on this, that by having an official audit, going back to our original discussion about exit sales, an official audit would probably help that process in some degree. Or not?
I have to be careful because I'm on the radio. It does. Whether an audit should do or not is debatable.
Okay.
Whether people understand that actually the majority of accounts are not audited, because we still have people in official places who should know better saying, can I have a copy of the client's audited accounts? He only turns over 1 million. He doesn't have an audit. He has an examination. Oh no, we want audited accounts. There aren't any.
Yeah.
The problem with audits, even for a small audit, we're usually looking at sort of £3,000-£4,000 to do, not above what we would normally do. Is it because we give that extra value? No, it's because we have an awful lot of forms to fill in.
Yep.
And there's a lot of requirements to give that. So most small companies don't have audits. They don't need them. To me, the increase up to 10 million is a sensible one.
Right.
But for those companies with outside shareholders or outside investors with loans who are, then they will still have those audits. So just because the threshold comes up doesn't mean you don't have to have an, or you can't have an audit, because you can.
Yeah. Okay.
Okay.
Cool. Thank you for that. There's a new data protection self-assessment tool. The ICO has launched a self-assessment tool to help small business owners assess their compliance with the Data Protection Act. The assessment covers the key obligations that small firms have when processing their customers' personal information, as well as providing links to relevant guidance. The new toolkit can be completed as one comprehensive assessment, or it can be accessed as separate checklists so users can adapt it to their individual business needs. If you'd like to find out more about that, there's a website which is ico.org.uk to find out about the new data protection self-assessment tool.
I've got another interesting European piece of legislation here, which may all become irrelevant from the end of June onwards. The European Commission has published draft legislation as part of its digital single market strategy. If implemented, the legislation would harmonise consumer law in relation to online shopping throughout the European Union, which the Commission hopes would result in more consumers purchasing goods online from traders in another member state. Interesting one, because, you know, how does it work with regard to the differences in taxation, for example? So, you know, countries that have a higher rate of VAT or excise duty or whatever, does that mean that they are now going to, you know, will that be to their detriment? Because shoppers find it cheaper to buy in France, you know, for their wine than they do in the UK. How's that all going to work?
Well, the last attempt at this that the European Union made for digital downloads ended up as a complete dog's breakfast, and effectively did exactly the opposite of what that email says they want to do. It stopped 400,000 British businesses bothering to trade anymore with the European Union. Because what the rule said was that in order to sell digital-based products across the European Union, you had to charge VAT at the prevailing rate of the person that was buying the download.
Right.
And you had to do that whether you even reached the VAT threshold or not. So even if you were unregistered for VAT, you had to determine the place of residence of the person buying your download and then apply VAT at the rate in that person's place of residence. When faced with a question that said, if I've got a couple and the gentleman's Polish and his wife is French and they're halfway across the Channel Tunnel with an iPad on their way on holiday to Belgium and they decide to buy a software travel guide, what rate of VAT do I charge?
Yeah.
Now, HMRC have a website that allegedly tries to sort that out for you, but most people just gave up and said, you know what, it's not worth me selling there anymore.
But so, if you have a destination-based system like that, and you, but you're actually then actively encouraging people from another country to buy goods in your country, but you're not going to get any of the tax benefit from it, how is local and central government going to benefit from that?
I don't want to give away my independence on this, but one of the reasons that this is just ridiculous is that actually contravenes the World Trade Organization rules on taxation of goods and services. It is actually the opposite of what the WTO say should happen, but they implemented it. So make of that what you will. There you go.
Roll on the end of June where we can wave goodbye to all this nonsense.
Well, we'll see. Well, but if the guys in What Earth have anything to say about it, they've already decided, apparently.
Yeah.
The Department of Business Information and Skills and the DCMS, Department of Culture, Media and Sport, are to review business access to broadband. The departments of BIS and DCMS are to conduct a joint review of business broadband following concerns raised by industry and the FSB that existing services may be inadequate and too expensive to satisfy future demand. About time, too. So they're basically going to find out why we have such appalling broadband in what is supposed to be a first world country, because businesses in the UK are now suffering from the lack of adequate broadband. And that, ladies and gentlemen, brings us to the end of our FSB News Roundup.
Channel Radio. Channel Radio News Update. Channel Radio News Update.
Well, so there we go. We're fast approaching the end of the show. Some interesting discussions and points of view and stuff like that. But I just want to tell you what's going to be coming up later today on Channel Radio. Immediately following the Business Bunker show at 4 o'clock, we have the delightful, the gorgeous, the lovely Natalie Benaig, who is presenting Kent Creative Live, the show for creatives, artists, and all things creative in the county of Kent. A fantastic show, do give it a listen. And it has a business slant to it. It's not just about creativity and art, it's about the business of creativity and art. And the creative industries are the fastest growing industry segment in the UK at the moment, currently worth £86 billion a year to the UK economy, and the creative industries are growing at £19 million a day. Which is fabulous news. So you can listen to Natalie at 4 o'clock with Kent Creative Live. That is followed at 5 o'clock by Mr. Craig Avery, the ladies' favourite. And he has some interesting show business interviews, music and chats. And he is on from 5 to 7 p.m. tonight. That is immediately followed by... Potatoes. 18 tracks of new, unsigned, up-and-coming music as hand-chosen for your delight and entertainment by Mr. Jamie Andrews on the New Potato Show from 7 p.m. to 9 p.m. And at 9 p.m. we have our comedy 60s show, I Was Lord Kitchener's Valet. And of course we round off the night with...
It's Club Culture with Boy George. 1, 2, 3,
get down! Full drum beat and a squidgy bass, I give you Vanilla Ace and it rhymes. That means I'm right on time. Welcome to Club Culture where I control my very own dance universe. 1 hour or more of grooving delectables for your disco pleasure. I'm Boy George.
It's 1 hour of delectable, delicious dance music. It's Club Culture with Boy George on Channel Radio.
So, once again, we round off the evening here on channelradio.co.uk with a fabulous Mr. Boy George and the Club Culture Show. So do stay tuned for all of those kind of shows. But we're kind of at the end of the Business Bunker again for another week. And it's been a fantastically brilliant show. We've heard from two great guests. And once again, I think we can wish a happy birthday to Mr. David Dicara.
Thank you very much indeed, guys. I'm still waiting for the champagne.
Yeah, absolutely. We rang ahead for a bit, but they just haven't got down here. And we also, so Mr. David Dicara, Toastmaster and MC extraordinaire, fantastic insights into the world of toast mastering. And we also heard from Stephen Askew, partner at Haynes Watts Chartered Accountants, where we had a fascinating discussion about exit plans and how to make a fortune out of your business or not, if you get it wrong. So thank you so much for both of you gentlemen for joining us on the Business Bunker Show.
That's a great pleasure. And if anybody has any questions about what I've said, I'll always take them and hope to answer them.
Okay, fantastic. So do get in touch with Stephen if you need to know more about how to plan to exit your business successfully. A big thank you to Martin White for stepping in and co-hosting the show. It's been an absolute pleasure.
Thanks, Paul. Jules, get working on those Easter eggs. Working them off, I mean.
Yeah, absolutely. But we will be back next week with the Business Bunker Show. For the meantime, we'll see you all soon.
Paul Andrews with the Business Bunker.